A young man of Pakistani descent comes to the U.S. He studies here, gets a job, and for a while he seems to thrive. But he gradually falls out of love with America. Feeling disillusioned and disenchanted, he returns to Pakistan, where he possibly joins a terrorist network. That may sound like the story of Faisal Shahzad, the man who's accused of trying to detonate a bomb in Times Square. But it's the plot of a novel, The Reluctant Fundamentalist, by writer Mohsen Hamid. The novel came out 3 years ago. Hamid now lives in Pakistan, but he has spent many years in the U.S., and he happened to be in New York City the night of the bombing attempt in Times Square. He joins me now from our bureau in New York. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What was your first reaction when you heard about the arrest of the suspect in the Times Square attempted bombing, Faisal Shahzad, and when you learned that he was from Pakistan?
Well, I reacted to it in two different ways. In one way, I mean, I had just come with my wife and baby daughter from Lahore, and I was relaxing, enjoying myself in New York. I felt my level of tension had gone down coming from Lahore, where things can get more dangerous from a terrorism standpoint. And suddenly, there was a rude shock, a reminder that we live in one world, and whether you're sitting in Lahore or New York, the same things can happen. The other reaction was the reaction to the fact that the man was a Pakistani-American. That was sad and depressing because, you know, these sorts of things will make life more difficult for everybody from Pakistan, but also because it's sad that these things keep tracing back to Pakistan.
Many people of Pakistani descent probably felt the things that you're describing right now, but for you there was another dimension to this, and it must have been a bit eerie because of the obvious resemblances between what happened in Times Square and the story that you describe or that plays out in your novel.
Yeah, I mean, my novel is a story of a man who comes to America, falls in love with America, and then falls out of love with America. It's the opposite of an immigration story. It's sort of an emigration story, how you come to leave the United States. And I think in the time after 9/11, when the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq were going on, and I wrote that book, I was trying to explore those sorts of feelings. When I saw the life story of this man, which in many ways, you know, does match with my protagonist's, there was a bit of a flash of recognition, although, of course, I don't know what went on inside this man's head beyond what I can imagine.
What is it about the perspective and experiences of a man who was raised in Pakistan that would make him fall out of love with this country upon moving here? What was it that you were trying to help people who read your novel understand?
A number of different things happened. One is there's a political dimension. There are American troops in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. There are drone attacks taking place in Pakistan. So it's very easy, if you come from a place like Pakistan, to imagine that there's a narrative of American aggression towards the place that you come from. But that in and of itself is just a political view. What makes it more dangerous is if it can coincide with a personal story. In my novel, the personal story is a man who is in America, but after a failed love affair and numerous other things, he is emotionally damaged by his time in the United States. And then he starts looking for where he should fit in. And that search takes him back to where he comes from. People get confused. You know, you're a very well-assimilated Pakistani-American living in the United States. Then things perhaps don't go so well. You begin to de-link from America, feel like an outsider. And then when you start feeling like an outsider, you think, you know, you're confused about your identity. Are you Pakistani? Are you American? And for some people, like myself, that's not a difficult thing. You say, look, I'm a bit of both. I'm a hybridized person. That's fine. But for others, it can be, I have to reject one of these two things that are confusing me. And in this case, it's rejecting America, trying to be just Pakistani or just Muslim, which, of course, isn't true to your own experience and isn't even true to your own identity. But if you begin to walk that path, it can lead to dangerous places.
You know, when you talk about the hyphenated experience, it's not unique to America. Many of the Pakistani-born men charged with terrorism in Europe have similar profiles, suburban comfort, good education, relative family wealth. And that seems to run counter to this popular notion that terrorism is largely bred and nourished in madrasas or among the disenfranchised.
Well, you know, the reason for that is that this type of terrorism is a phenomenon of globalization. It's about two cultures touching each other, and in the process of touching each other, generating this anger. So you have people who come from one culture, live in another, enter a state of sort of turmoil, and then lash out. It's not that this is a Pakistani man who's come to America. It's a Pakistani-American man who can't stand being Pakistani-American any longer.
And how does the events that played out in Times Square and what we, you know, will see in the news cycle as Faisal Shahzad is goes through the process of adjudication, how will that affect this process as Pakistani Americans or Pakistani Europeans read about this on the front page of the paper, hear about it on the radio, see it on television all the time?
Well, the way I tend to think about that is, you know, if we make a comfortable space for people to be Pakistani American, and similarly for people in Pakistan who aren't Pakistani American to be, you know, comfortable having American cultural exposure, you know, wearing jeans, listening to rock music, etc., then we create a kind of safe space. But as soon as we start saying that Pakistanis in America are suspect, then we start shutting down this positive space. So I think that the suspicion actually feeds off of itself and sets in motion a kind of dangerous exclusion that leads to people like this feeling they have to choose one side or the other.
America and Pakistan are two countries that will be intertwined for all kinds of reasons and quite likely for many, many decades now. Whether we're talking about diplomats or journalists or tourists or authors, what don't Americans get about Pakistan?
Pakistan now is like a horror film franchise. You know, it's Friday the 13th, episode 63, The Terrorist from Pakistan. And each time we hear of Pakistan, it's in that context. The thing about Pakistan is Pakistan, in a way, looks like the world. It's a diverse group of multi-ethnic, multilinguistic, multi-religious people who are doing all sorts of different things, you know, being teenagers, being lovers, being writers, being farmers. And when we continually talk about Pakistan in a security context, you know, we see Pakistan through the eye of a predator drone, we see, you know, a pair of crosshairs and a cave. But that's not any more accurate as a depiction of Pakistan than to see America as a, you know, as a missile silo. And what we too often don't do is recognize that Americans who could be killed in Times Square and Pakistanis who are killed in a market bombing in Lahore are actually very similar. Instead, we think, oh, what has America done to bring this attack upon itself? What has Pakistan done to create the people who did this attack? And, you know, those are valid questions. But equally important, perhaps, more important is to recognize how most of us are the audience for terrorism, not the perpetrators of it.
Mohsen Hamid, thank you very much for coming in to talk to us.
Thank you.
Mohsen Hamid is the author of The Reluctant Fundamentalist.
When you're drinking bottled water, do you ever wonder where it comes from? Is it really from the spring that it's named after? Is it really just purified tap water from a municipal system? Is it worth lugging home gallons of bottled water when you can turn on the tap in your kitchen sink? My guest Peter Glick has written a new book called Bottled and Sold that answers a lot of questions about bottled water and also describes some of the problems it's causing. Glick says every second of every day in the U.S., 1,000 people buy and open a plastic bottle of commercially produced water, and every second of every day, 1,000 plastic bottles are thrown away. Bottled water may taste good, but Glick says it's producing billions of tons of carbon dioxide and other pollutants. He says Americans should be insisting that their municipal water systems are maintained and upgraded so that they can provide public tap water that is safe and tastes good. Glick is a water expert who was named a MacArthur Fellow in 2003. He's the co-founder and president of the Pacific Institute for Studies in Development, Environment, and Security, based in Oakland. Peter Glick, welcome back to Fresh Air. Most bottled water has such healthy-sounding names, like with springs and glaciers in the title, but the water isn't often isn't from a spring, or at least it isn't from the spring you'd think it was from. You give a few examples in your book, like Arctic spring water is actually from Lakeland, Florida. Glacier Mountain natural spring water is actually from New Jersey. Are they from springs?
Well, we get most of our bottled water in the United States from two kinds of places. We get them from springs, and if you actually see the word spring water on the bottle, it's required to come from either a spring or, more likely, from a groundwater well that's drilled into where that spring comes from. Or about 40 or 45% of our bottled water actually comes from reprocessed municipal water. And that, of I mean, that's a story all by itself. But there are a bunch of strange names for bottled water. We get Arctic water from Tennessee or from Florida, certainly not from the Arctic. Yosemite water comes from Los Angeles. Everest water comes from Texas, and there are plenty of big things in Texas, but Mount Everest isn't one of them. And so part of the challenge is thinking about what's on the bottle and what they're really trying to tell us versus what's actually likely to be in that bottle.
Now, you mentioned that a lot of bottled water actually comes from municipal water and is then purified and reprocessed. So examples of that kind of water, bottled water that's actually from municipal water supplies, includes Dasani, which is produced by Coke, Aquafina, which is produced by PepsiCo, and Pure Life, which is produced by Nestle. So when bottled water actually comes from the municipal water supply, how is it transformed into bottled water? What do they do with the tap water to the municipal water to make it bottled water?
Many bottlers, and some of the big ones like Coca-Cola and Pepsi that produce Dasani and Aquafina, they take municipal water. They often run it through additional processes, other filters, some kinds of purification systems. For Dasani, for example, for the Coca-Cola product, they actually strip out all of the minerals and then they put minerals back so that Dasani that's bottled in New York or Dasani that's bottled in Detroit or Dasani that's bottled in the San Francisco Bay Area actually all tastes the same. They call it pixie dust or magic dust to make all of these bottled waters taste the same.
The pixie dust is the packet of minerals that they put in to reinstitute the taste that they took out when they took out the minerals during the purification process.
Yes, that's right. But you have to understand, this stuff originates as potable tap water in the first place.
When you buy bottled water that's actually purified tap water as opposed to spring water, does it tell you that on the bottle? Does it say this water is actually from the Philadelphia water supply or the New Jersey municipal water plant?
There is no requirement at the federal level that water bottlers put the source of the water on their bottle. There has been some pressure in recent years to make them do that, and some of the big bottlers are beginning to list their sources. But there's no requirement. But if it doesn't say spring water, you can be pretty sure it's probably coming from some purified municipal water system. Interestingly, Poland Spring, which I think you mentioned earlier.
But go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. is a Nestle brand. It's pretty well known on the East Coast. It's one of Nestle's many brands. But in the old days, Poland Spring came from Poland Spring, a spring in Maine that was known for its high-quality water. But the demand for bottled water from Nestle's and from Poland Spring has gotten so large that, in fact, there's almost no water coming out of Poland Spring anymore. They've overpumped it. And now Poland Spring Water is no longer a source of water. It's a brand name. And the stuff that's in a Poland Spring water bottle may come from any one of half a dozen or more springs somewhere in the Northeast.
But it's still spring water. But you're saying that you think the name is misleading? That most people think it's actually the Poland Spring that they're getting the water from, not just the brand name now?
I would think that if I didn't know better. I would think that Poland Spring water would come from that famous Poland Spring.
Well, actually, there was a class action suit that you write about in your book in 2003 that accused the company of false advertising. What was the outcome?
Well, that's right. Yeah, when the news sort of started to filter out that, in fact, Poland Spring water no longer came from Poland Spring, I think some consumer groups in Connecticut and Massachusetts sued Nestle. And now, if you look carefully at the fine print on a Poland Spring bottle, you'll see it says, this water comes, and I don't have one in front of me, but this water comes from, and it lists 6 or 7 or 8 different springs. They do list Poland Spring as one of the many springs, without specifying actually where it comes from.
Roddy Doyle writes about Ireland, but not an Ireland of green fields and picturesque country pubs. His first book, The Commitments, was about young people from a gritty part of Dublin who form a soul band. It became a hugely popular film.
They call me Mr. Pitiful. Baby, that's my name.
Doyle's new novel, The Dead Republic, is the final book in a trilogy about the fictional Henry Smart, a foot soldier in the Irish War for Independence. We catch up with Smart years later when he's working for the famous American movie director John Ford. Ford's best known for his westerns, but he wants to make a movie about Ireland, The Quiet Man, with John Wayne.
That humble cottage, who owns it now?
But the widow to learn, not that she lives there.
Think she'd sell it?
Would you should?
I'll bet on it, because I'm buying it.
Now, why would a Yankee from Pittsburgh want to buy it?
I'll tell you why, Michelin O'Flynn, young, small Michael Flynn, who used to wipe my runny nose when I was a kid. Because I'm Sean Thornton, and I was born in that little cottage over there. And I've come home, and home I'm going to stay.
In Roddy Doyle's novel, Ford promises Henry Smart that the Quiet Man will tell the story of his life with the IRA. But much to Smart's disgust, The Quiet Man becomes a love letter to rural Ireland.
John Ford created one of the great myths of American history and American culture, and he did the same with The Quiet Man for Ireland, a place that he loved, a place that he didn't know all that well, really, but like a lot of Irish Americans, absolutely adored the place.
Yeah.
It struck me as being Irish America's involvement with Ireland is a key point of Irish culture as well and Irish history. Kind of in the 50s, 60s, 70s, when Ireland was a bit of an economic backwater, we had to kowtow to a notion of what Ireland was in the hopes that tourists would arrive.
Henry calls The Quiet Man, this movie in particular, the emigrant's dream. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, is there a lot of anger in Ireland about the way it has been mythologized by those who left it?
I don't think there's anger. I've been to the, you know, the location where the film was made. The beauty of the landscape is there. There's no denying it. And actually, it's very easy to slip into a conversation that wouldn't be altogether different from some of the conversations in The Quiet Man. I don't think people would feel anger. It'd be more, I'd say at this stage, amusement as much as anything else.
When Henry read the final script of The Quiet Man, the script that was actually made into the movie, he gets so angry that he actually wants to kill John Ford. Now, why so much anger about a movie?
Henry feels, I suppose, that he has wasted his life somehow. It's a life full of drama and escape, but really he's been running away from things most of his life. And I suppose he sees the film as stopping and turning around and assessing his life, the ugliness of a lot of the things that he did, he thinks is going to be an important part of the story. But what happens is that basically in the compromises, his life, the reason why he was involved in this thing, kept slipping off the page. And the whole tone of the thing changed from being a story which exposes the ultimate stupidity of the Irish War of Independence from his point of view, and the grimness of the violence and the reality of shooting somebody in the head, actually becomes a celebration of rural Irish life and a wonderful comedy that had nothing in common.
Well, eventually Henry decides that he himself wants to lead a quiet life, but in many ways the past catches up with him and he becomes involved again in the IRA, in the modern IRA. Give us an idea of what those years were like in Ireland, especially the 80s with the bombings, the hunger strikes.
Things start getting ugly. At first he doesn't notice, but he's actually literally walking down a street in Dublin called Talbot Street, and a bomb goes off. And throughout the Troubles, very few bombs went off in Dublin. But I have vivid memories of this particular day because I actually heard the bomb. I was at home in a place where my parents still live called Kilbarrick. Myself and my mother were in the kitchen. I think I was literally just pouring myself a glass of water, and we heard this explosion. It was distant, but we knew immediately it was an explosion. But the bombing, the reprisals, the counter-reprisals, the kneecappings, all the ugliness, the horribleness was a daily part of the news, really. You could get on with your life, you could fall in love, you could, you know, get a job, you could do all the things that everybody does everywhere. But if you were Irish, you had to live with either trying to ignore the violence and feel guilty about it, or to confront it and feel guilty about it.
Henry begins to get drawn into the Troubles, and he starts to think that maybe little has changed. And there's a section I'd like you to read. It's on page 203.
Grand. Once I started paying real attention to Ireland beyond the parish, I realised it was 1920 again. Every stupid decision, every shooting, every rubber bullet, internment, Bloody Sunday, every strong rumour, British collusion in the planting of my bomb on Talbot Street and the other bombs that afternoon, all these sent young men and women queuing up to join. Approval was in the air, everywhere. The British were back, on the telly every night, taking over the streets 80 miles up the road. There were dead bodies, there were refugees, reprisal and counter-reprisal, terror and retaliation. It had gone on for 3 years, in my day. It went on for decades, this time, and it was still my day.
So much of this book is about clashing visions of Ireland. And,
yeah.
and in the end, an IRA man tells Henry that the war had always been about what it means to be Irish. He says it's about the copyright, the brand, as he calls it. I mean,
yeah.
Is that true?
I think so. In many ways, Ireland is a very self-conscious place because of, say, the Irish-American links, because we speak English. We seem to punch beyond our weight, so to speak, that who controls what it is to be Irish and what it is that we can be comfortable with seems to me vitally important. And it's happening again now in many ways because the economy, as you're probably aware, has hit, if not rock bottom, pretty close. And I suppose while the bankers and the politicians have let us down, culture really hasn't. And suddenly the power of books and literature and, to a lesser extent, I suppose, film has come to the fore again. My concern about that is that who's going to define that culture? Will it be us, the citizens of Ireland, who actually live there? Or will it be some sort of marketing department of the civil service who will try to define what Irish culture is in the hopes of enticing people to arrive and spend their money? So, you know, definitely when I was a kid, if you didn't speak Irish, you really wanted to. And you played Gaelic games and you didn't pay any attention to what was happening in the outside world because really Ireland was the centre of the universe. And I don't think that's the case anymore. Although, admittedly, it is the centre of the universe.
Roddy Doyle, his new book is The Dead Republic. Thanks so much. It was great talking with you.
Thank you.
And you can read an excerpt from Roddy Doyle's new novel, The Dead Republic, on our website, npr.org.